Welcome to the Costume Plot.
I'm JoJo Siu.
And I'm Sarah Tim. We're professional designers with a passion for costume design and the performing arts. Our podcast does contain spoilers.
We hope you'll join us every other week as we delve into the wonderful world of costume design in the Costume Plot. To our bonus episode.
Surprise!
Yay! Extra episode this month. I'm really excited. We, of course, are trying to cover some smaller things around. You know, this is going to be our first of many bonus episodes, hopefully.
Yeah, this is going to be a little more informal, like not as much research, just kind of like a discussion about what we think. And of course, we're talking about Bridgerton,
which
we have, I know that you said that people have been asking you, people have been asking me too, if we're going to cover it. So here it is. You're welcome. Yep,
I know. It's finally here, the episode.
Hopefully we're not too late in the game. I feel like it's still getting a lot of buzz. So I feel like we're right in the sweet spot to it talk
is.
About it.
And like, I'm, you know, there's been so much other coverage of Bridgerton. So this is certainly not going to be hugely different than maybe whatever else you are hearing about Bridgerton. But these are just kind of our thoughts as costume designers, as people who have been doing this for a long time, just to kind of share, you know, instead of the bashing maybe that we've been hearing about this show, talking a little bit about kind of what are the purposes behind it and how to really talk about design in a intelligent way and maybe not spending so much time on the negative, I guess.
Yeah, I don't think we're going to get too spicy. I don't think we're going to have like really hot takes about it. I think that in general, like we can usually find positives and negatives in pretty much everything. And that doesn't mean that it's bad or not worth our time.
Mm-hmm. Before we get into that, I did want to make a quick announcement. For our next month's episode, we are going to be covering our first musicals, which I'm super excited about. But one of the ones that we do want to cover is actually going to be Meet Me in St. Louis. And the reason why we wanted to bring this up is because they do actually have online Zoom performances. So this theater, it's the Irish Repertory Theater in New York. They're an off-Broadway theater. They do a lot of really great work, but for this particular production, they are doing a predominantly Zoom production. So it is going to be, quote unquote, live theater, but all over Zoom. So I'm really excited about how this is going to be done and excited to see this take because this is a really great show. It's actually one of my favorites. It was one of the ones I did in high school. And I was really involved on like every aspect of the production. So it has a really special place in my heart. But it's going to be directed and adapted by Charlotte Moore. And I'm really excited. It's going to be more of a costume coordinated piece, but we're in talks with the actual theater to just, you know, eventually we will get in touch with the lady who's going to be coordinating. But she's going to talk a little bit more eventually about some of the work that she had to do on a Zoom production versus what we would typically do on a live production.
Yeah.
So if you get the chance to see it, it's completely free. They do try to ask for donations if you have the capability to give donations. But it is the irishrep.org is their website. Just look for Meet Me in St. Louis. And you'll be able to get free tickets. You just have to reserve your spot. They do have only a few remaining performances. So it's January 31st is their most current upcoming one. And then they are also performing on February 3rd, the 11th, and the 21st. So if you get the chance, please go and see that performance if you can. So hopefully you can kind of be involved with us. And that way when we go over the show in the episode, then you'll know what we're talking about.
Yeah, we're going to have pictures. And like the reason we got in touch with the theater is to see if they could send us some of their pictures because we were like worried about whether we could take screen caps of the show and like if that would even like interrupt our own like enjoyment of watching it. Because it's not something that we can rewatch. I looked and it was like you have to catch it. It's on YouTube Live. So you have to catch it at the exact time or you're going to miss it. So they were super nice and seemed excited that we were featuring them, which is so sweet.
I know.
And we're hoping that the designer can like answer a few questions before the episode. But if not, like we definitely want to have her on for a future like interview episode.
Yeah, definitely. What a great way to connect theater artists in this way, too.
Yeah. And I mean, I miss theater so much that I'm excited to talk about theater with people. So like, yeah. That prospect is very exciting to me.
Very cool. So anyways, that's my little plug for next month. So hopefully for our audience listeners out there, just be prepared to hear about Maybe in St. Louis.
Yeah.
And hopefully go and see it online.
Mine is much easier to access. I'm going to be covering Hamilton. So I think a lot of people have seen it on Disney Plus. So just, you know, gird your loins, prepare yourself.
It's going to be an exciting episode. Yeah. So yeah, back to Bridgerton. Just to give you a little bit of background about the show, for those of you who have not seen this yet, I wanted to kind of talk a little bit about the directors, which in this case, there were actually four different directors. So each of the directors took two different episodes each. We have Cherie Folkson, who has done the very obscure movie, The Decoy Bride, but it's got David Tennant in it. So any of you Doctor Who fans out there, she did that movie, which is great. Alric Riley, who's done a lot of like random episodes here and there for NCIS, How to Get Away with Murder, The Good Doctor, Lucifer. Julianne Robinson, who's also done kind of sporadic episodes on like Magic, One for the Money, and Brooklyn Nine-Nine. Mm. And then Tom Verica, who actually does a lot of acting. He was a main actor in How to Get Away with Murder and The Closer. And then he's directed a few episodes of The Umbrella Academy, Scandal, and Private Practice. So these are all directors, obviously, that come with a little bit of experience. The other thing I wanted to mention, too, is that for the costume team for this show, it was a four-person co-costume team. But it was pretty much headed by Ellen Mirajnik, mm-hmm. Who, of course, is known for her work in The Greatest Showman, the newer Maleficent sequel. Victoria Quelch is one of the other costume designers or co-costume designers. She's probably the most brand new costume designer. She doesn't have other projects under her belt, but this was a great way for her to get involved with a really star team.
Well, yeah, this is making a big splash. So this is a good
absolutely
thing to get your name out there.
For sure. John Norster, who's done a lot of assistant and associate costume designing, but he also worked on Maleficent. He did Aladdin, Justice League, Pirates of the Caribbean, Dead Men Tell No Tales, and also Inception, among many others. And then John Glazer, who did a lot of TV costume designing. So he's done Gotham, Person of Interest, and Brotherhood, also among many other listings. So just to give you just the sheer volume of these teams, because the show is humongous.
Yeah, it makes sense that the team is so big because, well, they built 7,500 costumes. That's what we've learned in our research. And I could tell watching the show, I was like, they built all of this. Like, you can just see it, you know, except for stuff on like background and stuff.
Mm-hmm. And I think I can't remember where I wrote it. Oh, here it is. So it took them 5 months for a team of 238 people to build these 7,500 pieces.
Woo!
5,000 costumes, full body costumes, were in front of the camera. And 104 costumes were for Daphne Bridgerton alone.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, the sheer amount of just volume.
Imagine how many fittings. Like,
it's insane. Like, they must have had to move. Like, no one slept for these 5 months.
That's like a month of fittings. Like,
yeah, pretty much. And, like, multiple fittings.
Crazy.
Because, you know, even though these costumes are not, not all of them are quite as incredibly crazy to build as, you know, say Queen Charlotte's costumes from the 18th century. But you know, it takes more than one costume fitting for a lot of these. Sometimes you don't get that and you just gotta figure it out.
Mm-hmm.
So it's pretty amazing what this costume team has accomplished in this short period of time. Because, you know, 5 months to some people sounds like a lot of time, but for that many costumes, that's nuts.
Yeah, yeah. She said that she hired 5 cutters and 2 tailors just for the principals, which I'm not sure like who counts as a principal in that case, but like that's That already seems like not enough people for that many costumes.
I was going to say, that team sounds so ridiculously small for the amount of costumes. Like, for 104 costumes for one of the leads alone. I know. Like,
oh, Lord. Like, it's just it's a real big, like, it's hard to even, like, wrap my mind around how big of an undertaking this show was.
Yes. Yeah. So just to kind of introduce that before we really start talking about the costumes. Yeah, it's pretty insane. We did want to go over some of the designer's thoughts on this, because I think one of the biggest things that we've been hearing from a lot of other critics about the costumes is, of course, the historical accuracy.
Yes.
And there is nothing historically accurate about this show.
Well, the silhouettes.
I shouldn't say nothing. I did want to read a really quick quote from one of the interviews with Ellen. She said her color palette was shifted, and this is paraphrasing, of course, but rather than doing the 1815 or 1811 to 1820, which is really the time period of the Regency era that we're in, she chose to be inspired by the more 1950s and 1960s silhouettes. And then she said one of the big inspirations was the Christian Dior Designer of Dreams exhibition. And then she also had very specific restrictions and rules on set. So she banned muslin dresses, which, as you know from our last episode on Emma, muslin dresses were very common for this time period. She totally did away with that because she felt that they were too limp. So a lot of the choices in fabric that she made for this show were definitely much more structured and not quite as light and cottony, I guess, in feeling as the typical muslin. And then she also, like, got rid of bonnets.
Yes. Yeah, that's a pretty big deal.
Yeah.
So you said that she did 50s and 60s silhouettes, because in the research I saw, she said she used, like, that was a color inspiration.
The colors, yeah.
Okay, yeah.
Sorry, colors, not the silhouettes.
I have a quote here about the fabric. She said, like, that silk and fancy stuff wasn't being imported from France like it usually was because of the war, which is why people were using cottons more often. Mm-hmm. So it is very interesting to see Regency done in fabrics that aren't muslin and, you know, gauzy cottons and stuff, because that's what we're so used to. And I found it really refreshing. I think it's really vibrant and fresh.
Yeah. And I think a couple of her interviews talked a lot about her wanting the costumes to be really accessible, was the word that she used. And, you know, accessible means different things to different people. But I think where she really saw that the most was with Lady Danbury and Simon in particular. And we will be talking briefly about those.
Yeah.
And of course, we're only really giving you a snippet because, of course, this is our bonus episode. We don't have the time to go through every episode of Bridgerton because there's so many costumes.
That could be a whole season of podcast episode. Every episode.
For sure.
Yeah.
Breaking it down.
We're not doing that.
So we will talk a little bit more about what that accessibility really looks like visually. But yeah, it was just really interesting that she said that. And then the other thing I wanted to mention too was just the fact that she really kept Queen Charlotte in a very accurate to the true Queen Charlotte, who decided to stay in the late 18th century silhouette. So apparently the real Queen Charlotte did that in real life, and she wanted to honor that same idea by putting the queen and her court in all of these 18th century gowns, even though the rest of the lead cast is mostly in kind of more Regency era, pushed about 20 years later.
I was wondering about that because, like, in my research for Emma, I was talking about how people didn't want to be associated with, like, the French aristocracy because of the revolution. And then I saw Queen Charlotte dressed, like, in a Marie Antoinette silhouette, and I was like, what?
What's happening? So, I think I had that same thought initially. So it was cool to hear what Ellen's thought process was behind that.
Yeah, and I mean, her costumes were, like, incredible, obviously. All of them are incredible.
Yeah. And I will say the other thing, and we've talked a lot about how much costumes can really affect different things when we change and shift color. And I think this show was a lot more about the color and the vibrancy than it was about historical period accuracy.
Yes. Which,
again, going back to that whole 1950s, 60s color palette, that's exactly what she's done. She's really taken that and applied it over a period, you know, costume silhouette and made it sort of more contemporary. Because that is kind of the trend we're returning to a little bit today, is we still see the 1950s and 60s as a very classic color and silhouette. So I think she did a really good job of marrying kind of a more contemporary style and emotion with that period without making it seem too dated.
Definitely. I have a quote from her about like sort of accessibility. She said the Shondaland aesthetic, and Shondaland is referring to Shonda Rhimes, who is like the exec producer, right? Mm-hmm. Usually airs on aspiration, beauty, and lusciousness in a way that makes the modern audience want to be in the story. So I think that's what the accessibility is. It's like, it, if you see like a beautiful Regency gown, like people like us will be like, oh my gosh, I want it. But like an mm-hmm. average person might not feel that way. But like when you right. bring it into 2020 with like your fabrications and your colors, it makes people go, oh my gosh, I want to go there. I want to put on that dress. It's so pretty, you know? So that's, it makes yeah. the audience, it like draws them in a way that like strict period accuracy sometimes doesn't.
Mm-hmm. And it's interesting too, because I, you know, we're talking about color vibrancy, but I think about color psychology so much, and this the colors that she's chosen and like the textures that she's chosen to use. It kind of has that same feel as, you know, I mean, this was from a while ago, but like that sweater that we talked about for Chris Evans, you know, it's like things like that where she's able to take the subtleties of the texture and color, and that's what draws the audience in.
Mm-hmm.
Like for some reason, I always think about this quote that like, you know, the McDonald's arch, the red and the yellow actually makes us salivate. And that's why people get drawn into McDonald's. And it's like the kind of the same thing. This vibrant color makes us sort of salivate over these costumes.
Yeah.
And kind of get drawn in and get sucked into this world. So I think she's done a really good job of that. And I did want to at least point that out, despite the kind of all over the place historical silhouette accuracy. Like, I think outside of that, she's done a really great job.
Yeah. Yeah. We were talking about this before we got on mic, but like a lot of the people who are talking about the costumes in this show, like make the whole discussion about the lack of period accuracy. And I think that kind of misses the point, because the designer has like straight up said that's not what they were going for. So to act like you're sticking it to her by telling her that it's not accurate is like just kind of beside the point. Like you're
right. Right. That's kind of missed the mark already.
Yeah.
I mean, she straight up told us that that's not the point.
Yeah. It's like, yeah, we know that. Like, let's talk about it in words that aren't those things, you know?
Yeah. That's not the language we're following here. Yeah. So yes, I think we wanted to focus on obviously a very specific scene. And this is sort of later in the season, so it's not really a spoiler scene, but it is something that we felt like was a good representation of kind of one of their more party scenes, I guess.
Yeah.
And we both focused on a female look as well as a male look.
Mm-hmm.
And again, this is pretty casual, so we're not going as in-depth as our normal episodes.
Yep.
But Sarah, why don't you start with your looks?
So, yeah, we picked a specific episode and we were talking about like, oh, should it be the first episode? And then we were like, we need people to know that we watched more of it than just the first episode. So we picked episode 7 because it has a scene that we both really like, which is the scene where Daphne goes to the like married ladies gambling night.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm going to talk about Daphne's dress that she wears there, because I think it's a fabulous example of everything we've been talking about. Specifically, color-wise, the Bridgerton family are all in these like cool powdery blues, and Daphne really stays in that land for pretty much all of the show. So this dress is like a satin, and I just really love it's like a powdery blue satin, and I love the, where's my, there it goes. I love the like surface decoration on it. And what's her name? Mirajnik? Is that how you say it?
Yeah. Ellen.
Ellen said that they did a lot of hand beading. So I think this one might be an example of that, because it has these like beautiful, like iridescent Aurora Borealis sort of crystal beads on it.
Guys, this is one out of 104 costumes.
104.
made for this actress. And this was hand-beaded. So crazy.
I think it's a great, this is a great example of what we were just talking about, where she did the period silhouette, but out of like modern fabrics. And I actually have a picture of her in a fitting from one of the articles right here. Isn't that Ooh. Fun? Yeah. I feel That's like great. With 104 looks, like that many fittings, the actress just kind of feels like a mannequin at that point. I got a picture of the back too. It has a nice long train. I noticed a lot of trains in the show.
Yes.
And I was like, is that a thing that they did? And then I think it is. Like, if you're just kind of around the house or if you're going to a fancy occasion, you'd have a train. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I really like this. Her hair is down, which is like, you know.
Very natural, very contemporary.
Yeah. And I want to talk a little bit about corsets, actually. I know this is not a picture of her in her corset, but I feel like it's a good time to sort of plug in this discussion that we want to have. And one of the first, I think it's in the first episode, there's a scene of someone getting like tight laced into a corset.
I think that's the opening scene.
Yeah, you might be right. And this is where I'm going to get a little spicy. I have a problem with like how corsets are portrayed in media, because people nowadays think of them as this like torture device where everybody was squishing their organs and women couldn't breathe. And some people were doing that. It depends on the period, actually. Mm-hmm. Like some of the ideal silhouettes had a tiny, tiny waist and some didn't. But to the women of the time, it was like wearing a bra. And most of them were not squeezing the daylights out of their own bodies. And it's not like a strictly unhealthy thing to wear a corset.
So, especially for this time period.
Yes.
I think that was one of the loudest things that I heard, was that whole lacing situation would not have been appropriate for this time period. Because, again, you're cinching in the waist in that image. And really, the silhouette at this time was not about the cinched in waist.
Correct.
It was very much up at the umpire. So,
yeah.
So that whole scene seems a little bit kind of illogical or irrational.
Yeah.
Considering the dresses they're wearing.
It just contributes to like the weird like reputation that corsets have. And I think it's a little bit lazy, because like every period film has one of those scenes now. And it's like, show us something else. Like,
yeah. Do something different with that.
Yeah. And then the other thing is the lack of chemise, which it, for those who don't know, a chemise is kind of, is an underlayer that goes under your corset. It's kind of like a little nightgown looking dress slip sort of thing, usually made of cotton, you know, really breathable and comfy. And it's to prevent your corset from, you know, rubbing or irritating you. Mm-hmm. And this show also shows, I can't remember what character it is, but someone is like taking off their corset and has like full like bruises or like blisters from it. And I was like, give me a break. Like,
that's not accurate.
Where's your chemise?
Right. And if you think about it, the chemise kind of acted like, you know, I guess our modern equivalent would be like the men's undershirt, right?
It's yeah.
sort of that inner layer of, you have something underneath the outer clothes, because that's the layer that would also be your, like your sweat layer, essentially.
Yeah.
And that's what would be getting dirty and get rewashed over and over again.
Correct.
And then they wouldn't have to wash the outer layer as often.
Yep.
So the chemise didn't just function as an inner layer to protect you. It also was a very practical garment.
Yeah, it's like undies. Like, it's your innermost layer. Yeah. So that's our take on that.
That's our spicy level, guys.
That's a spicy level. And then I'll move along to Simon. He doesn't go to that gambling party because he's a man. But I wanted to talk a little bit about his wardrobe broadly. I have a quote. The designer says he's traveled the world and has come back to London, so he brings with him another sensibility. And then also, like, his sexiness was a big factor in deciding what he was going to wear. And I think we can really see that in the fact that he rarely is wearing a stock or like a high collar. His throat is pretty much always exposed. So the stock is like the tie that ties, like it's like a, usually it's white for men in this period, and it would like wrap several times around their neck and then tie in sort of like a bow at the front. And he if he's wearing anything, he wears sort of like a loosely knotted cravat, which you can see in this picture of him in the gray velvet outfit. Mm-hmm. And he, like, I think there's like a real sexiness to the fact that his throat is always exposed. And I mean, he's beautiful to look at, so.
Yeah.
And then I love the, you know, luxness of the fabrics here. I love gray. And, but he also, as sort of like a visual foil to Daphne, is usually wearing something warm toned to mm-hmm. like contrast with her cool tones. So he's usually wearing like burgundy or like butterscotch caramel colors. And in this one, he has a red little cravat thing. And I think that that's really effective because he's like sensual, you know, and worldly.
It's very much a passion color.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, so that's Simon. I think I have one of him. Nope. There. This one is him in his shirt sleeves in a different vest, and it's like a brocade sort of paisley pattern. And it's once again, it's like his necktie is like open, and he's like looking very sort of half undressed, and but like very luxurious because like the necktie is very silky, and then like the waistcoat is very rich looking too. So it's just like you can see sort of the worldliness and also like the money and the sexiness all in his outfits.
Yay!
I think that's all I have to talk
nice
about.
Nice and brief.
Yeah, we're just, you know, breezing through it.
Yep.
We don't want
to
be here.
Well, and again, there's so many characters in the show that it's not possible for us to cover every single one of them with the time we have.
But yeah,
we did want to touch a little bit on some of the, you know, main leads. So I love that you focused on our two, you know, they really are our two leads of this story.
Yeah. All right. Do you want to tell us what you pulled?
Yeah. Okay. So let me share my screen. So I focused on some kind of more peripheral characters, but I love that the characters I actually focused on are basically like the support system for Sarah's two characters. Anthony Bridgerton is the brother, the older brother of Daphne, who he's kind of taken over the family now because the father is just not in the picture. And so he's kind of had to take on a lot of that burden. And then, of course, Lady Danbury is the one that I did want to focus on first. And Lady Danbury, in the same way, is kind of the familial support who kind of raises Simon.
I love her.
Me too.
I just more of her.
I love her character, and I just wish that they had incorporated her more. She's like a no-nonsense character. Everything about her is very, I wouldn't even say masculine, because she's very, very feminine in the way she dresses, but just the way she carries herself is very masculine in a lot of ways. And so the dress that I focused on at this gambling party, she appears in, of course, that deep maroon that's very reminiscent of Simon as well. Mm-hmm. And so I think Ellen did a really good job of really tying in these families together by color.
Yes.
And that's really how she's separated each of the different worlds. And you really see the difference in class and status as well. So for Lady Danbury, let's see, I think the other picture is, yes, this is, and you never really see a full body picture of this because this is film. But I love that this really does honor the Regency. One of the things that I really took into account was that she's the only one at this party in full long sleeves. Mm. There's one other lady that I think is slightly older, and even she only had like a quarter, like a three-quarter sleeve. But Lady Danbury, as the host of this party, is the only one with the full kind of longer. And again, there's something very masculine about the sleeve that they've given her. And they've even kind of, what did I write? That they have a flared cuff on her sleeve, which you can't really see that well in this picture, but it's, you know, it's right at her wrist. And it's also actually even a little bit longer than her wrist, which I'm not really sure if that was, like, what the intention of that was. It almost makes it look like it's too big for her, but there's something kind of masculine about the shoulder width that they've given her in this particular look. And then the fact that they've given her this really structured kind of pleated area that kind of like frames her bust. So again, this kind of very masculine, almost Spencer jacket looking garment or police garment that we talked about from Emma That's worn over this really beautiful, same thing as Simon, that velvet kind of luxurious fabric for the dress underneath. One of the things that I did want to point out with her, it's interesting because even her hairstyle, it's sort of like a halfway between the Marie Antoinette kind of piled up look and the more natural look of Daphne and the more contemporary kind of Regency styling that they've chosen to give to this world. So she's, it's interesting to me that she isn't quite the royalty character, but she's almost like the one step down from Queen Charlotte. So there's like kind of different hierarchies of who all these people are and what status they belong to and what wealth bracket they belong to. So I wanted to focus on that. She again is also in those really warm kind of passionate colors because I do also see her character as very passionate. So I really loved that. And I think they did a really good job of tying her in with Simon very well.
Yeah.
And even though they're not in the scene together in this particular frame, you can definitely see the association between the two of them.
I want to say about that sleeve. I've seen that like extended sort of cuff that like sort of hits the knuckles. I've seen that happening. That's like a now thing, I think, that they have added because I've seen it in like some high fashion menswear where like it'll be like a blazer, like a tailored jacket, but then the cuff flares out at the bottom and like goes past. Right.
It's like intentionally longer. Yeah.
So that's a fun contemporary little touch.
Yeah. So this was a really good marrying of like contemporary and, you know, that period. What else did I write on here? I mentioned the kind of wider, more masculine shoulders. I think one thing that was really interesting was I was thinking a little bit more about like Joan Crawford from like the late 1940s and sort of that same idea of like the really broad shoulders on a very feminine silhouette. And I think that was some of what I was getting. I don't know if that was what Ellen intended, but that was sort of the same feeling I was getting from this, especially knowing that she kind of was utilizing 1950s and 1960s colors, and that she, I think there was something in one of the interviews that mentioned her looking at the new Dior look of the 1947 era. So just sort of bringing in even some of like small, subtle details of that silhouette, you can definitely see that in this costume.
Yeah.
And then to focus on Anthony, and like, you know, we've talked in the past about how interesting menswear is in comparison to women's wear, and it's usually not, there's not, I don't want to say that it's not interesting, but there's not as much to talk about, I feel like.
Yeah, it's still pants and shirts.
And I can't really say that, but but even in this particular scene, you know, Anthony actually does feature a pretty standard tuxedo from that era, the Regency tuxedo, and it is a cutaway coat. One of the things that I do love about this is that in comparison to the luxurious like velvets of Simon, he's certainly in more of a traditional kind of almost wool. It looks like wool. I don't know if that's exactly what the material was, but just based on the images that we're seeing here, you know, it's a pretty traditional black and white. That's pretty standard for tuxedos of that time. And like, you know, they would have dressed really nice. And I think Anthony's family is still at a level of wealthiness that he can afford, you know, nicer fabrics. Not that they're not all wearing really nice fabrics, but just sort of styled in different ways. He really does have his neck mostly covered for a majority of the time. And I don't think that has anything to do with not wanting him to be sexy, because he certainly sleeps around quite a bit in the show as well. But there's this sense of he constantly needs to look put together. And there's this uptightness about his character because he basically has the entire family's reputation on his shoulders. So they've really kept him, his neck really wrapped up in this scene. And again, kind of going back to that separating of him versus Simon in this scene, I think it's a really good juxtaposition of the two of them across from each other, because he's so well done up with his stock and his ascot in place versus Simon, who I think in this scene, he's got like nothing around his neck. So it's essentially just that kind of open. And it's almost like a modern sensibility when we think about like the unbuttoned shirt, right?
Yes.
That's a more casual look for men when they leave their chest open versus when they have a fully done up button at the neck. So they definitely did that to separate these two men in general. I also love the shape of this vest. Like, It is very Regency, and I think that's been, like, obviously, I think, let me go back. But I was going to say, like, I really love that Ellen stuck to more of the traditional Regency silhouette for this, because I think this definitely looks much more Regency and much more close to the historical silhouette of that time, for men especially.
Yeah, he looks more so traditional too, and that makes sense with his mm-hmm. character, because he cares so much about, like, the standing of his family and their reputation and, like, adhering to tradition. So him wearing, like, a more period accurate Regency thing makes sense, especially next to Simon, who is, like, more modern and, like, yeah. doesn't really care about that kind of thing. Even though, I mean, he cares about his family, but, like, not in the way of, like, reputation right. or, like,
yes,
tradition definitely. Or whatever.
Very different priorities, yeah. for sure. And then, like, again, this is such a small detail, but the fact that he's got so many of those gold buttons, like, again, it's kind of a show of wealth. Mm-hmm. If you actually look at a lot of the fashion plates from this time period, his jacket is much more open than the ones that you typically see in that time period, which you can, I don't know if it was just the designer being like, let's feature that thing. Like, we worked so many hours on this costume, let's do it. And you can't necessarily, you don't necessarily see the color in this one, but there were a couple interviews I was looking at where you do get to see a lot more color for the menswear. And it is mostly like dark blues and navies, but they're very rich blues that you see in other episodes of this season. This particular look is a little closer to the traditional black, but I do love that Ellen has thrown in some of those other deeper colors for menswear and didn't just keep it all black tuxedos all the time.
Yeah. I like the blue that he wears, but I will say that I did not realize that, like, all three of the white men were Daphne's brothers until, like, several episodes in, because they're virtually indistinguishable from each other and they all wear the same yeah. color. So I thought that some of them were the same person. I didn't realize there were three of them. Like,
so funny. Yeah, and I feel like they're kind of carbon copies of each other. I don't think there was as much of a distinctiveness between the three brothers.
Yeah. Toward the end, they develop more of their own personalities, but, like, not at the beginning. At the beginning, I was like, wait, who's this one? Like, didn't we just see him?
Wait, they're not the same person?
Yeah.
Yeah. So I think, overall, you know, obviously this show was definitely one of those shows that you kind of get sucked in very fast. So that's why we wanted to cover it. But I think, you know, rather than looking at all the historical anachronisms that are in this, because, again, that is not the point of these costumes. I think just being able to enjoy how contemporary this is and how, you know, Shonda has brought in a lot of the kind of diverse cast and mm-hmm. the diverse even the diverse culture that she's created in this world, I think is definitely the bigger point that we want to focus on for this show.
Yeah, I think it's a beautiful sort of, like, fantasy, you know, because it's based on books and they're basically like mm-hmm. fantasy bodice ripper romances, and
yeah.
you want to be able to escape into that world. And I really like that the world she's created for us to escape into is so colorful, so diverse, so different and unique. Like, and when's the last time a period drama like this made such a splash? Like, I can't remember.
Yeah, it's very true.
One getting this popular, like, recently. So clearly, mm-hmm. like, they have a winning formula happening.
For sure.
And they're doing
and they have
right.
8 more seasons left of this, so
there's lots of books, right?
There's going to be plenty of material to cover.
Yeah, I like how it's sort of like a Regency era Gossip Girl, basically. That's what it is.
Yeah. I literally, when I started watching this, I was going to ask my husband to watch with me, and he was like, wait, so this is just Gossip Girl, but set in the Regency era? He was, like, so disinterested. So I was like, okay, you don't have to watch with me.
Oh, man.
But yes, very much a Gossip Girl vibe.
Yes, yes. I mean, shout out to, like, I have a couple of straight male friends who were really into it. So shout out to them. I hope they yeah. listen, because they asked me if I was going to cover it. So you better listen.
Yep, here it is. And that does conclude our episode, our little bonus episode of this. We're at 40 minutes.
Pretty good.
We're trying to keep this short.
I'll trim some out, good. You know, and then it'll be like 35 or so.
Yeah, exactly. So hopefully you've enjoyed our very brief coverage of Bridgerton. It's a fun show to watch. It's easy to get sucked into. There's a lot that happens, and now there's 8 more seasons that are, you know, projected after this. So looking forward to that and more of Shondaland.
Yeah, it's a nice little escape from the real world for a while. Watch pretty people fall in love. What could go wrong?
Exactly. In the Regency era.
Yeah, beautiful.
Perfect. Well, thanks, Sarah.
Thanks, JoJo.
This was fun. And look forward to our musical theater episode coming in next month.
Yep. Look forward to that. Perfect. And watch Meet Me in St. Louis.
Yes.
Okay.
Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
We'll see you next time.
Bye.
Bye.
Thank you for listening to The Costume Plot. You can follow us on Twitter and Instagram at The Costume Plot. If you have a question, comment, or a movie suggestion, you can email us at thecostumeplot@gmail.com.
Our theme music is by Jesse Tim, and our artwork is by JoJo Siu. Please rate and review us wherever you listen to your podcasts.